Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to the Hour of the Time with your host here, Doyle Shamley, in Eager, Arizona. Now, I want to thank all of you for tuning in this evening, and this is our next segment in our current broadcast series, The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy, tonight being part four in this series. And it's Monday, February 22nd, 2010. Now, first, the cursory information. If you'd like to write the Hour of the Time, you may do so by writing Hour of the Time, or HOT, H-O-T-T, P.O. Box 940, Eager, spelled E-A-G-A-R, Arizona, 85925. Again, that's Hour of the Time, P.O. Box 940, Eager, Arizona, 85925. The website, hourofthetime.com, that's hourofthetime.com, and my personal email address, if you'd like to write me to share research, inquire about items, hate mail, whatever, it's hourofthetime@hotmail.com, that's hourofthetime@hotmail.com. And the studio numbers in Arizona, 928-333-2942, 928-333-2942, and in Canada, 613-733-4324. That's 613-733-4324. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I want to remind all of you that the Hour of the Time is listener-supported. I have noticed some of you in the chat room asking some of the most ironic questions about, well, where do I get this research? Where do I get that research? Yet you don't even take the time to listen to the stream. So we've been turning many of you onto the stream, trying to beat that through your head that we're not going to sit here and broadcast a stream every night of new material and then turn around and retype it all for you just because you don't want to listen. So if you are one of those that's finally tuning in to the stream, hold off on the questions when we've already addressed the issue on the air. That is the best way. Also, many of you want full personalized transcriptions written to you about subjects we've already covered in depth on the air or at conferences via DVDs. Now, that will no longer take place. We are listener supported, ladies and gentlemen. We already work absolutely for free, Rob and I do, and many others. So, for us to turn around and already distill and format and distribute the work and then retype some personal response to you because you choose to be a lazy socialist and not donate for an MP3 bundle on the very topic that you're asking questions about, that is your problem. From now on, the time is done for babysitting, ladies and gentlemen, and many of you need to quit throwing your little temper tantrums, put on your big girl panties, and grow up. And that takes me to the news link list as well. I am very saddened by many members of the news link list, especially as of late, that are absolutely obviously not reading or paying attention to a single thing that I take the time to gather with the help of many of you out there, proofread, verify, compile, and then send out. And then post in different mediums, like the chat room, for instance. You seem to choose to ignore what's sent right to you via email and what's posted at various locations and make suppositions about current events or historical events when the answer was right in front of you. I've even pointed out, read this right here. Look at this paragraph. And it was totally ignored. And that's been going on a lot lately. So I am making another decision. Tonight, my emailing list, I've already started today, is getting severely gutted because I'm no longer going to waste time on people if they feel they can just play around, don't need to read anything, and waste our time. I'm not wasting it anymore on you. You've made that decision. So I'm getting it. We're going to keep active with the people that want to do research, want to read, and want to pay attention. And the rest of you can just fall by the wayside. That some people are going to gripe and bellyache, I know. Oh, that's not fair, and blah, blah, blah. No, it is fair. It's absolutely fair. So, it is too bad that we have to make such drastic decisions. But the simple fact is a lot of our efforts are being wasted on people who insist on just spouting off, not reading what's sent right to them, even though they requested it, not paying attention, making suppositions, second-guessing, not listening in detail. There's a big difference between hearing and listening. And it really saddens me, some of the people on the various news lists that quite frankly aren't listening at all. So we're going to make drastic decisions too, to save ourselves from repetitive work. Now, ladies and gentlemen, again tonight after this musical break, as always, be prepared to take notes. This is part 4 in our series on the Israel lobby and U.S. foreign policy, Monday the 22nd of February, 2010, with your host here, Doyle Shamley, on The Hour of the Time. Alright, ladies and gentlemen, again, your host here, Doyle Shamley in Eager, Arizona, with the Hour of the Time. Tonight, part four in our series on the Israel lobby and U.S. foreign policy. And ladies and gentlemen, this goes hand in hand with many other broadcast bundles that you can donate for and help support the Hour of the Time, because we are listener supported. The ADL series, the Zionist Violation series, Mystery Babylon 1, 2, or 3, and the DVD series is like John Daniels Bundle Package 4 Disc, the Three Wise Men DVD. There are several out there, ladies and gentlemen. Go to our website, hourofthetime.com, and go to the Hot Shop. Now, to recap briefly, part 3, because we had a interruption of about a week due to severe hacking that seems to all be linked directly to the broadcasting. But oh well, I'm not going to stop. So unfortunately, it creates a lot of work for Rob, though. But I'm going to say what I'm going to say. So, a brief recap of how we ended part 3 was under policing academia, if you will, and I've been giving you headings for your notes. And a classic illustration of the effort, ladies and gentlemen, to police academia occurred in late 2004, when the David Project produced a propaganda film alleging that faculty in Columbia University's Middle East Studies program were anti-Semitic and were intimidating Jewish students who defended Israel. Columbia was raked over the coals in pro-Israel circles. But a faculty committee assigned to investigate the charges found no evidence of anti-Semitism, and the only incident worth noting was the possibility that one professor had responded heatedly, that's a quote from the report, to a student's question. The committee also discovered that the accused professors had been the target of an overt intimidation campaign. Perhaps, ladies and gentlemen, the most disturbing aspect of this campaign to eliminate criticism of Israel from college campuses is the effort by Jewish groups to push Congress to establish mechanisms that monitor what professors say about Israel. Schools judged to have an anti-Israel bias would be denied federal funding. This effort to get the U.S. government to police campuses have not yet succeeded, but the attempt illustrates the importance pro-Israel groups place on controlling debate on these issues. Finally, a number of Jewish philanthropists have established Israel studies programs, in addition to roughly 130 Jewish studies programs that already exist, so as to increase the number of Israel-friendly scholars on campus. For instance, ladies and gentlemen, New York University announced the establishment of the Taub Center for Israel Studies on May 1, 2003, and similar programs have been established at other schools like Berkeley, Brandeis, and Emory. Academic administrators emphasize the pedagogical value of these programs, but the truth is that they are intended in good part to promote Israel's image on campus. Fred Laffer, the head of the Taub Foundation, makes clear that his foundation funded the New York Center to help counter the, quote, Arabic point of view, end quote, that he thinks is prevalent in New York University's Middle East programs. In sum, ladies and gentlemen, the lobby has gone to considerable lengths to insulate Israel from criticism on college campuses. It has not been as successful in academia as it has been on Capitol Hill, but it has worked hard to stifle criticism of Israel by professors and students, and there is much less of it on campuses today. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I want to give credit, of course, like we did the other broadcast in the series, to Professors Mearsheimer and Professors Walt. Professor Mearsheimer of the University of Chicago, and Professor Walt of the John F. Kennedy School of Government, Harvard University, for this working paper. It was also published in the London Review of Books, ladies and gentlemen, and then, of course, greatly suppressed. Now, ironically, about 5 years ago, these gentlemen obviously had nothing to do with my broadcast 5 years ago, but this dovetails in intrinsically with my Zionist violations. Now, I just did that series previous to this one, and it is available as an MP3 bundle, ladies and gentlemen, for your research, that has over 50 years, mind you, of history wrapped up in there. Well, these gentlemen had written this paper, and have, to give you an example, more pages of footnotes and bibliographical references than they do actual tests. It is so authenticated, researched, and supported. To give you an idea, roughly 42 pages of straight bibliographical references and footnotes, and only 41 pages of actual text. Now, those of you who were wise listened to our earlier offers and got the entire bibliography. For your research, you will have hundreds and hundreds of hours of additional reading on these topics in foreign affairs, and I hope you do that. Now, ladies and gentlemen, the next section of your notes you should call the silencer, or the great silencer, if you will. Because no discussion of how the lobby operates would be complete without examining one of its most powerful weapons, that is, the charge of anti-Semitism. Anyone who criticizes Israeli actions or says that pro-Israel groups have significant influence over U.S. Middle East policy, an influence that AIPAC celebrates, stands a good chance of getting labeled an anti-Semite. In fact, anyone who says that there is an Israel lobby runs the risk of being charged with anti-Semitism, even though the Israeli media themselves refer to America's quote-unquote Jewish lobby. That, ladies and gentlemen, again from the Israeli media. Their words, not mine, the quote-unquote Jewish lobby. In effect, ladies and gentlemen, the lobby boast of its own power and then attacks anyone who calls attention to it. This tactic is very effective because anti-Semitism is loathsome and no responsible person wants to be accused of it. Europeans have been more willing than Americans to criticize Israeli policy in recent years, which some attribute to a resurgence of anti-Semitism in Europe. We are, quote-unquote, getting to a point, the U.S. ambassador to the European Union said in early 2004, quote, where it is as bad as it was in the 1930s, end quote. Measuring anti-Semitism is a complicated matter, but the weight of evidence points in the opposite direction. For example, in the spring of 2004, when accusations of European anti-Semitism filled the air in America, separate surveys of European public opinion conducted by the Anti-Defamation League and the Pew Research Center for the People and the Press showed that it was actually declining. For instance, ladies and gentlemen, consider France, which pro-Israel forces often portray as the most anti-Semitic state in Europe. A poll of French citizens in 2002 found that 89% could envisage living with a Jew, 97% believe making anti-Semitic graffiti, is a serious crime, 87% think attacks on French synagogues are scandalous, 85% of practicing French Catholics reject the charge that Jews have too much influence in business and finance. It is unsurprising that the head of the French Jewish community declared in the summer of 2003 that, quote, France is not more anti-Semitic than America, end quote. And according to a recent article in Haaretz, the French police report that anti-Semitic incidents in France declined by almost 50% in 2005. And this, despite the fact that France has the largest Muslim population of any country in Europe. Finally, when a French Jew was brutally murdered by a Muslim gang, tens of thousands of French demonstrators poured into the streets to condemn anti-Semitism. Moreover, President Chirac and Prime Minister Villepin both attended the victims' memorial service in a public show of solidarity with French Jewry. It is also worth noting that in 2002, more Jews immigrated to Germany than Israel, making it the fastest-growing Jewish community in the world, according to an article in the Jewish newspaper Forward. And that's a quote, the fastest-growing Jewish community in the world. That's Germany, not Israel. And that's according to an article in the Jewish newspaper Forward. If Europe were really heading back to the 1930s, ladies and gentlemen, it is hard to imagine that Jews would be moving there in large numbers. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, this is your host here, Doyle Shamley in Eager, Arizona, with the Hour of the Time. Again, the website, hourofthetime.com. My personal email address to share research, offer suggestions for broadcasting, hate mail, what have you, is hourofthetime@hotmail.com. The studio number in Arizona, 928-333-2942, and in Canada, 613-733-4324. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I have been on many jaunts lately, and I guess it was appropriate timing with all the hacking that occurred of our website, which Rob worked diligently day in and day out to fix, mainly due to our broadcasting. It appears, based on the frequency and occurrence periods and times of hacking versus particular broadcasting. So, I have done my best as I hop in and out of the studio to grab new supplies, head out again with DVDs, hit the road talking to officials around the western U.S. here, and keep up with emails, of course, by dragging my laptop everywhere with me and phone messages when I'm in and out. But what's really odd is that somehow, ladies and gentlemen, the listening audience has taken a downturn. You were doing so good on the messages, being very concise, a name, what's the message about, and contact info. Preferably a clearly spoken email address, as I said many times on the air, because then I can write it down and be hitting on the road and answer you still in a timely manner. It seems to have taken a downturn lately. One gentleman with the same voice, leaving the same number, left me three different names. like I'm stupid and I'm going to actually waste my time calling him back. If you don't know your own name, please don't waste my time. Or if you're trying to cover up something, quit changing your name and leaving messages with the same phone number. Also, I asked everybody to be concise and clear, and I have two gentlemen who called that I can't return a call to because on the message, it appeared that they were possibly on a wireless, either in a home with interference or a cell, possibly, probably a cell. Either way, it wasn't the clearest, but they made sure to give out their number that I've never heard before, like as if I did the studio number 928-333-2942. I have no way to even tell what numbers they said. So, ladies and gentlemen, try to use your noodle there, because out of the, from this last weekend, for instance, 19 messages, there were only 1, 2, I got my pad here with the dates and times, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 out of 19 that I can even call back. So, and these are the same types now that'll probably bellyache later because they didn't get a personal call back. Ladies and gentlemen, that all keeps running up cost. So let's try to use those little heads out there a little bit more often. And I don't need any more calls, please, about all the UFOs you found in your secret jobs in the government. Okay? I've heard it over and over. And ironically, a gentleman called this weekend that I've already spoke to in person. He called at 4 in the morning, and I was up in the studio working. And I took the call because it rang. And he told me his whole spiel. I told him, if you can prove up on it, show us some facts, put it in writing. He said he couldn't. Because email would be too difficult. He didn't know how it worked. Yet he was a high-level microwave scientist. And he doesn't know how email works? So I said, well, just write it. The good old regular mail. You can write, surely, if you're a scientist. Send it regular mail. Well, that would be too much effort, too. Ironically, the same number and voice, same phone number, called back, and it's another gentleman, excuse me, another occurrence of someone now giving me a whole different name. I have a call log here, ladies and gentlemen. Changing your name on me isn't going to work. It makes me leery. It makes me assume you are lying. You have something to hide. You're wasting my time. Ladies and gentlemen, let's be part of the solution, not the problem out there. There's no way to restore Republican form of government with behavior like that. It's impossible. So let's stop it, okay? Now, we were talking about, ladies and gentlemen, in this part 4 in our series on the Israel lobby and U.S. foreign policy, about the charge of anti-Semitism, how it's used as a weapon to silence criticism, legitimate criticism of the Israel lobby, or as it's called by Israeli media, the Jewish lobby. And it's corrupt and often bad effect on U.S. policies, foreign policy most notably. Now, to continue on, we recognize, of course, and however, that Europe is not free of the scourge of anti-Semitism. No one would deny that there are still some virulent anti-Semites in Europe, as there are in the United States. But their numbers, ladies and gentlemen, are small, and their extreme views are rejected by the vast majority of Europeans. Nor would one deny that there is anti-Semitism among European Muslims, some of it provoked by Israel's behavior towards the Palestinians, and some of it straightforwardly racist. The problem is worrisome, but it is hardly out of control. Muslims constitute less than 5% of Europe's total population. And European governments are working hard to combat the problem. Why? Because most Europeans reject such hateful views. In short, when it comes to anti-Semitism, Europe today bears hardly any resemblance to Europe in the 1930s. This is why pro-Israel forces, when pressed to go beyond assertion, claim that there is a new anti-Semitism, which they equate with criticism of Israel. In other words, criticize Israeli policy and you are by definition an anti-Semite. When the Synod of the Church of England recently voted to divest from Caterpillar Incorporated on the grounds that Caterpillar manufactures the bulldozers used to demolish Palestinian homes, the chief rabbi complained that it would have the most adverse repercussions on Jewish-Christian relations in Britain. Why, Rabbi Tony Bayfield, the head of the Reform movement, said, quote, "There is a clear problem of anti-Zionist, verging on anti-Semitic, attitudes emerging in the grass, roots, and even in the middle ranks of the church," end quote. Now let me go back to that again, because many of you may not remember that happening. It was actually sent out on the news list, ladies and gentlemen, years ago. When the Synod of the Church of England recently voted to divest from Caterpillar Incorporated on the grounds that Caterpillar manufactures the bulldozers used to demolish Palestinian homes, the chief rabbi complained that it would have the most adverse repercussions on Jewish-Christian relations in Britain, while Rabbi Tony Bayfield, the head of the Reform movement, said, quote, "There is a clear problem of anti-Zionist, verging on anti-Semitic, attitudes emerging in the grassroots and even in the middle ranks of the church," end quote. However, the church was neither guilty of anti-Semitism or anti-Zionism. It was merely protesting Israeli policy. Critics are also accused of holding Israel to an unfair standard or questioning its right to exist. But these are bogus charges too. Western critics of Israel hardly ever question its right to exist. Instead, they question its behavior towards the Palestinians, which is a legitimate criticism. As an aside, ladies and gentlemen, simply see the Zionist Violations MP3 series for documentation on that. And in fact, ladies and gentlemen, to the point, Israelis question it themselves. Nor is Israel being judged unfairly. Rather, Israeli treatment of the Palestinians elicits criticism because it is contrary to widely accepted human rights norms and international law, as well as the principles of national self-determination. And it is hardly the only state that has faced sharp criticism on these grounds. In sum, ladies and gentlemen, other ethnic lobbies can only dream of having the political muscle that pro-Israel organizations possess. The question, therefore, is what effect does the lobby have on U.S. foreign policy? Yes, ladies and gentlemen, your host here, Doyle Shamley, in Eager, Arizona, with the Hour of the Time. The website, hourofthetime.com. The studio number in Arizona, 928-333-2942. And in Canada, 613-733-4324. My personal email address, hourofthetime@hotmail.com. Now, ladies and gentlemen, the question before us, therefore, is what effect does the lobby have on U.S. foreign policy? And this heading for your next section of notes could certainly be called the tail wagging the dog. If the lobby's impact were confined to U.S. economic aid to Israel, its influence might not be that worrisome. Foreign aid is valuable, but not as useful as having the world's major superpower bring its vast capabilities to bear on Israel's behalf. Accordingly, the lobby has also sought to shape the core elements of U.S. Middle East policy. In particular, it has worked successfully to convince American leaders to back Israel's continued repression of the Palestinians and to take aim at Israel's primary regional adversaries, Iran, Iraq, and Syria. How do they go about demonizing the Palestinians? And it is now largely forgotten, but in the fall of 2001, and especially in the spring of 2002, the Bush administration tried to reduce anti-American sentiment in the Arab world and undermine support for terrorist groups like Al-Qaeda by halting Israel's expansionist policies in occupied territories and advocating the creation of a Palestinian state. Bush had enormous potential leverage at his disposal. He could have threatened to reduce U.S. economic and diplomatic support for Israel, and the American people would almost certainly have supported him. A May 2003 poll reported that over 60% of Americans were willing to withhold aid to Israel if it resisted U.S. pressure to settle the conflict. And that number rose, ladies and gentlemen, to 70% among quote-unquote politically active Americans. Indeed, 73% said that United States should not favor either side. Yet, ladies and gentlemen, the Bush administration failed to change Israel's policies, and Washington ended up backing Israel's hardline approach instead. Over time, the administration also adopted Israel's justification for this support approach, so that U.S. and Israeli rhetoric became similar. In fact, by February 2003, a Washington Post headline summarized the situation. Quote, Bush and Sharon nearly identical on Mideast policy. End quote. The main reason for this switch is the lobby. You see, ladies and gentlemen, the story begins actually in, guess what, September 2001, when President Bush began pressuring Israeli Prime Minister Sharon to show restraint in the occupied territories. He also pressed Sharon to allow Israeli Foreign Minister Peres to meet with Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat, even though Bush was highly critical of Arafat's leadership. Bush also said publicly that he supported a Palestinian state. Alarmed by these developments, Sharon accused Bush of trying to, quote, to appease the Arabs at our expense, end quote, warning that Israel, quote, will not be Czechoslovakia, end quote. Bush was reportedly furious at Sharon's linking him to Neville Chamberlain, and White House Press Secretary Ari Fleischer called Sharon's remarks unacceptable. The Israeli Prime Minister offered a pro forma apology, but he quickly joined forces with the lobby to convince the Bush administration and the American people that the United States and Israel faced a common threat from terrorism. Israeli officials and lobby representatives repeatedly emphasized that there was no real difference between Arafat and bin Laden, and insisted that the United States and Israel should isolate the Palestinians' elected leader and have nothing to do with him. The lobby also went to work in Congress. On November 16, 2001, 89 senators sent Bush a letter praising him for refusing to meet with Arafat, but also demanding that the United States not restrain Israel from retaliating against the Palestinians, and insisting that the administration state publicly that it stood steadfastly behind Israel. According to the New York Times, the letter, quote, stemmed from a meeting 2 weeks ago between leaders of the American Jewish community and key senators, end quote, adding that AIPAC was, quote, particularly active in providing advice on the letter, end quote. By late November 2001, relations between Tel Aviv and Washington had improved considerably. This was due in part to the lobby's efforts to bend U.S. policy in Israel's direction, but also to America's initial victory in Afghanistan, which, ladies and gentlemen, reduced the perceived need for Arab support in dealing with so-called Al-Qaeda forces. Sharon visited the White House in early December and had a friendly meeting with Bush. But, ladies and gentlemen, trouble erupted again in April 2002 after the IDF launched Operation Defensive Shield and resumed control of virtually all the major Palestinian areas on the West Bank. Bush knew that Israel's action would damage America's image in the Arab and Islamic world and undermine the war on terrorism. So he demanded on April 4th that Sharon, quote, halt the incursions and begin withdrawal, end quote. He underscored this message 2 days later, saying this meant, quote, withdrawal without delay, end quote. And then on April 7th, 2002, Bush's National Security Advisor, Condoleezza Rice, told reporters that, quote, without delay means without delay. It means now, end quote. And that very same day, Secretary of State Colin Powell set out for the Middle East to pressure all sides to stop fighting and start negotiating. Now, ladies and gentlemen, again, you can see key documentation to that in the Zionist Violation series, the ADL series, Mystery Babylon, etc., all via our hot shop on our website, hourofthetime.com. Now, ladies and gentlemen, at that point, Israel and the lobby swung into action. A key target, you see, was Powell, who began feeling intense heat from pro-Israel officials in Vice President Cheney's office and the Pentagon, as well as from neoconservative pundits like Robert Kagan and William Kristol, who accused him of having, quote, virtually obliterated the distinction between terrorists and those fighting terrorists, end quote. A second target was Bush himself, who was being pressed by Jewish leaders and Christian evangelicals, the latter a key component of his political base. For instance, Tom DeLay and Dick Armey were especially outspoken about the need to support Israel, and DeLay and Senate Minority Leader Trent Lott visited the White House and personally warned Bush to back off. The first sign that Bush was caving came on April 11th, only 1 week after he told Sharon to withdraw his forces, when Ari Fleischer said the president believes Sharon is, quote, a man of peace, end quote. Bush repeated this statement publicly upon Powell's return from his abortive mission, and he told reporters that Sharon had responded satisfactorily to his call for a full and immediate withdrawal. Sharon had done no such thing. But the President of the United States was no longer willing to make an issue of it. Meanwhile, Congress was also moving to back Sharon. On May 2nd, it overrode the administration's objectives and passed two resolutions reaffirming support for Israel. The Senate vote was 94-2. The House version passed 352-21. Both resolutions emphasize that the United States, quote, stands in solidarity with Israel, end quote, and that the two countries are, to quote the House resolution, now engaged in a common struggle against terrorism. The House version went on to also condemn, ladies and gentlemen, my voice is worn out tonight, quote, the ongoing support of terror by Yasser Arafat, end quote, who was portrayed as a central element of the terrorism problem. A few days later, a bipartisan congressional delegation on a fact-finding mission in Israel publicly proclaimed that Sharon should resist U.S. pressure to negotiate with Arafat. And then, on May 9th, a House Appropriations Subcommittee met to consider giving Israel an extra $200 million to fight terrorism. Secretary of State Powell opposed the package, but the lobby backed it, just as it had helped author the two congressional resolutions. Powell lost. In short, ladies and gentlemen, Sharon and the lobby took on the President of the United States and triumphed. Hemi Shalev, a journalist for the Israel newspaper Maariv, and I probably mispronounced that, so my apologies, but it's spelled M-A, then like an apostrophe, A-R-I-V. And his name again, Hemi Shalev, he reported that Sharon's aides, quote, could not hide their satisfaction in view of Powell's failure. Sharon saw the white in President Bush's eyes. They bragged, and the president blinked first, end quote. But it was the pro-Israel forces in the United States, not Sharon or Israel, that played the key role in defeating Bush. And ladies and gentlemen, the situation has changed little since then. The Bush administration refused to deal further with Arafat, who eventually died in November 2004. It has subsequently embraced the new Palestinian leader, Mahmoud Abbas, but has done little to help him gain a viable state. Sharon continued to develop his plans for unilateral disengagement, as they called it, from the Palestinians, based on withdrawal from Gaza coupled with continued expansion on the West Bank, which entails building the so-called security fence, seizing Palestinian-owned land, and expanding settlement blocks and road networks. By refusing to negotiate with Abbas, who favored a negotiated settlement, and making it impossible for him to deliver tangible benefits to the Palestinian people, Sharon's strategy contributed directly to Hamas's electoral victory. With Hamas in power, however, Israel has another excuse not to negotiate. The administration has supported Sharon's actions and those of his successor, Ehud Olmert, and Bush has even endorsed unilateral Israeli annexations in the occupied territories, reversing the stated policy of every president since Lyndon Johnson. U.S. officials have offered mild criticisms of a few Israeli actions, but have done little to help create a viable Palestinian state. Former National Security Advisor Brent Scowcroft even declared in October 2004 that Sharon had President Bush, quote, wrapped around his little finger, end quote. If Bush tries to distance the United States from Israel, or even criticize Israeli actions in the occupied territories, he was certain to face the wrath of the lobby and its supporters in Congress. Democratic Party presidential candidates understand these facts of life as well. That's right, ladies and gentlemen, which is why John Kerry went to great lengths to display his unalloyed support for Israel in 2004, and why Hillary Clinton is doing the very same thing in her run. Maintaining U.S. support for Israel's policy against the Palestinians is a core goal of the lobby. But its ambitions do not stop there. It also wants America to help Israel remain the dominant regional power. Not surprisingly, the Israeli government and pro-Israel groups in the United States worked together to shape the Bush administration's policy towards Iraq, Syria, and Iran, as well as its grand scheme for reordering the Middle East. All right, ladies and gentlemen, again, your host here, Doyle Shamley, with the Hour of the Time, the website, hourofthetime.com. My personal email address, hourofthetime@hotmail.com, the phone number for the studio in Arizona, 928-333-2942, and in Canada, 613-733-4324. Now, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to wrap up tonight with just touching the tip of the iceberg concerning Israel and the Iraq War. You see, ladies and gentlemen, pressure from Israel and the lobby was not the only factor behind the U.S. decision to attack Iraq in March 2003, but it was a critical element. Some Americans believed this was a quote-unquote war for oil, but there is hardly any direct evidence to support this claim. Instead, the war was motivated in good part by a desire to make Israel more secure. According to Philip Zelikow, a member of the President's Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board from 2001 to 2003, Executive Director of the 9/11 Commission, and then Counselor to Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, the quote-unquote real threat from Iraq was not a threat to the United States. The quote, unstated threat, end quote, was the, you guessed it, quote, threat against Israel, end quote. And Zelikow told a University of Virginia audience in September 2002, noting further that, quote, the American government doesn't want to lean too hard on it rhetorically because it is not a popular sell, end quote. Then, on August 16, 2002, just 11 days before Vice President Cheney kicked off the campaign for war with a hardline speech to the veterans of foreign wars, the Washington Post reported that, quote, Israel is urging U.S. officials not to delay a military strike against Iraq's Saddam Hussein, end quote. By this point, according to Sharon, strategic coordination between Israel and the U.S. had reached, quote, unprecedented dimensions, end quote, and Israeli intelligence officials had given Washington a variety of alarming reports about Iraq's weapons of mass destruction programs. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I want to thank all of you for tuning in this evening to the Hour of the Time, and I hope you took notes, and I hope all of you have a safe and a studious evening.